and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Wednesday, October 6th. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, Iowa's GOP senators reject proposed election maps. Nonpartisan agency has 35 days to come up with another option. This story by James Lynch, Aaron Murphy, and Rod Beauchart for the Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. A plan that would have thrown more than 60 incumbent legislators into election districts with at least one other lawmaker and dramatically changed the state's four congressional districts was rejected Tuesday by the Republican majority of the Iowa Senate. Senate File 620, a proposal based on the latest census to redraw legislative and congressional election boundaries for the next 10 years, was voted down on an 18-32 party line vote after State Government Committee Chairman Roby Smith, Republican from Davenport, told colleagues there were clear indications that Plan 1 can be improved by a second iteration. However, Senator Pam Jokum, Democrat from Dubuque, who has been through the redistricting process two previous times, said the plan was more than fair. "It's independent," she said. "It does not give an advantage of one party over the other, nor should it. Nor does it take into account where any of us live, nor should it." Since 1981, Iowa has used a nonpartisan redistricting process that is considered a model because it eliminates gerrymandering, a process politicians and political parties use to draw districts to their benefit. In Iowa, the proposed maps are drawn by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency's legal and data analysts. The boundaries are supposed to be drawn without consideration of political ramifications, such as how new district lines will affect individual lawmakers' re-election chance or the balance of power. More than 250 Iowans commented on the proposal during public hearings. Not all of them liked the plan, but the consensus was that Iowa's nonpartisan process is the gold standard, Jokum said. Fair, independent maps give people the power of their voice at the ballot box, Jokum said. Addressing the compactness of proposed districts, Smith referred to an Iowa House district. There are two in each Senate district, with a perimeter of more than 300 miles, making it nearly as large as many Senate districts. State law calls for the maps to be drawn, as much as possible, in square, rectangular, or hexagonal shapes so as to avoid irregular-shaped districts. Smith pointed out a triangular district, a pyramid, and one so irregular it looks like the 1800s salamander known for gerrymandering. 18 districts were within 100 people of exceeding or failing to meet the ideal population by 1%, the deviation allowed by law, Smith said. These deviations, along with compactness, should improve to better meet the standards as required under the state constitution and statute, Smith said. Voting down the first plan does not violate the gold standard. Rather, the process in Chapter 42 provides clear directions on multiple iterations of a redistricting plan. Immediately following the vote, Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, Democrat of Coralville, blasted the GOP majority for breaking with decades of nonpartisan redistricting tradition, taking a big step closer to rigging Iowa elections. "This is a clear signal Republicans are willing to use a partisan gerrymander to keep themselves in power, regardless of the will of the people," Walls said. "Now is the time for Iowans to make their voices heard, contact their legislators, and demand that Republicans stop going down their dangerous road." The Republican vote to reject SF 620 should not be seen as an attack on the redistricting process, said Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitmer, Republican from Ankeny. "We have a great redistricting process in Iowa. It's looked at as one of the best in the country," he said. "Republicans are following the state law, and part of that process is an up or down vote on Map 1. We chose to vote it down and move on to Map 2. That's just part of the process." With the defeat in the Senate, the House did not take up the redistricting plan. However, House Speaker Pat Grassley Republican from New Hartford, agreed with GOP senators that the objections were not unwarranted. Rejecting the first plan is not unprecedented, Grassley said, a reference to the 2001 plan that, like the plan rejected Tuesday, would have created 60 incumbent-on-incumbent districts. Iowa House Republicans stand ready to do our due diligence to ensure the second set of maps is a fair map for the people of Iowa, he said. But House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, Democrat from Windsor Heights, said Republicans chose politics over the common good again today. Iowans, she said, don't want politicians using their political power to stack the odds in their favor. The process now turns to the agency to prepare a second map. Like the first, lawmakers will vote it up or down without amendment. If that is rejected, a third map will be prepared. If they choose, lawmakers can amend that one, essentially drawing their own map. But time is not on their side. The state code and constitution call for the legislature to complete redistricting by September 15, or the Iowa Supreme Court finishes the job. Due to census delays across the nation, the agency received the needed population data in mid-August and delivered the first plan 5 weeks later. Now the agency has up to 35 days to submit a second plan, and lawmakers will have to come back to vote on it. Under legislative rules, state House and Senate members receive their regular daily expense money for the special session, which amounts to $175 for most lawmakers and $131.25 for those residing in Polk County. The court has given lawmakers until December 1 to complete the process. Leaders in both parties say it would be difficult to get to a third map before then. This is an uncharted territory, Walls said after the Senate adjourned. We're obviously operating now under the authority of the Supreme Court because of the delays. Today was an opportunity to put to bed the uncertainty, and I think the concern around this process that both sides share. Redistricting is a process of redrawing congressional and state legislative boundaries to reflect population changes found in the decennial census. In 2020, the Census Bureau found that although the state gained 144,014 residents, 68 of Iowa's 99 counties had lost population since 2010. The growth largely was in Iowa's most populous counties. The fastest growing county was Dallas, west of Des Moines, with an increase of 50%. Johnson and Linn counties grew by 16.8% and 9%, respectively. Polk grew by 14.3%. Scott County grew 5.7%. That resulted in larger rural districts. In some cases, there were two or three incumbents in a proposed district, which meant they could have faced one another in a 2022 primary or general election. The same situation occurred in some metro areas. The second map will have the same issues that this map has because that's where Iowans live, Confirst predicted. It's not just rural areas that lose representation as the population shrinks there. U.S. House seats are apportioned on the basis of population. Iowa's population has been growing for 30 years, but other states have grown faster, gaining a larger share of congressional seats. In 1910, both Iowa and California had 11 representatives in the U.S. House. Today, California has 53. Iowa has had 4 since 2011. Also on the front page this morning, curriculum helps students prepare for future. This story by Grace King. Cedar Rapids High School students will learn to identify and manage their feelings as the district rolls out a social-emotional learning curriculum in all 4 high schools for the first time. Adding the curriculum to Kennedy, Jefferson, Washington, and Metro high schools will teach students the tools to regulate their emotions and even collaborate and problem solve together better, said Justin Blitz, Director of Culture and Climate Transformation for the Cedar Rapids Community School District. It is prioritizing the development of the whole child, Blitz said. When students are better able to identify their feelings, I think we will have a more positive culture and a place where people feel safer. Social-emotional learning is the developing of healthy identities, managing emotions, setting and achieving goals, showing empathy for others, establishing and maintaining friendships, and making responsible and caring decisions. The curriculum, called Habitudes Leadership, will be a class every high school student takes once a week during homeroom. Habitudes is a 4-year curriculum. While all high school students this year will have year one of the curriculum, today's freshmen will be able to work through all 4 years of the curriculum during their high school career. It also is designed to teach college and career readiness. Cedar Rapids Elementary and Middle Schools have established social-emotional learning curriculum, but research tells educators it's equally important at the high school level. Schools that implement social-emotional learning see an 11% boost in academic performance, he added. Bleets also noted employers are reporting social-emotional competency as one of the most important skills employees can have. Students will be surveyed 3 times on their social-emotional development throughout the year. They will be asked questions about their current classes, their behavior, their feelings, and how other people help them. For example, students will be asked, "How confident are you that you can complete all the work assigned in your classes? How much did you care about other people's feelings? How often are you able to pull yourself out of a bad mood? Do you have a teacher or other adult at school on whom you can count to help you no matter what?" Sean Thompson, a Kennedy High facilitator, said it's a dramatic shift to offer social-emotional learning during homeroom. Students traditionally met in homeroom for school activities such as voting for homecoming court and for standardized testing. Facilitators have a variety of duties, including relationship building, tracking attendance, disciplining, and even monitoring the lunchroom. The curriculum will give educators a common language to talk with students about their emotions and how to make decisions, as well as what the long-term impact of those decisions might be, Thompson said. Cindy Ritchie, also a Kennedy High facilitator, is working with teachers to develop social-emotional lessons. One of the lessons they discuss is impulse control, she said. For example, if a student has an urge to do something they know they shouldn't, identifying that can help avoid an unwanted behavior, Ritchie said. "We talk about every learner future ready as our motto in Cedar Rapids," Ritchie said. "It's not just about educating students academically. They have to know who they are as a person and how they fit into the world." The final front page story today by Trish Mahaffey, Lynn's top prosecutor retiring before the term ends. Lynn County Attorney Jerry Vandersanden says that working as a prosecutor is like being on a carousel. It never stops to let you off because the cases just keep coming, so you have to choose your time to leap. Vandersanden, 64, announced his leap Tuesday at the Lynn County Board of Supervisors, saying it seemed like a practical time to retire after being the elected county attorney for over 11 years and serving more than 38 years in the office. "What I realized is we are taking applications to fill an assistant county attorney position since Valerie Clay was appointed to the bench last month, is that all the applicants were all born after I started in this office," Vandersanden said, laughing. "I've recommended the board appoint my first assistant, Nick Maybanks, to finish out my term. It makes the most sense because he intends to run for county attorney. He has the support of the entire staff and is a key reason for our success. He is an excellent trial attorney who has handled some of the most complex cases in the office." Vandersanden pointed to Maybanks' prosecution of the cold case of the murder of Michelle Martinko, 18, who was fatally stabbed in her parents' car in a parking lot at the then newly opened Westdale Mall. The crime haunted Cedar Rapids for nearly 40 years until her killer, Jerry Burns, 67, of Manchester, was identified and finally brought to justice last year. Nick is the only one in this office that intends to run, Vander Sanden told the Gazette during an interview after the board meeting. He will make an excellent county attorney if chosen. The county supervisors could instead decide to call a special election so voters could choose a person to serve the remainder of Vander Sanden's term, which expires next year. No decision has been made. Vander Sanden, a Democrat whose current salary is $190,492.28, has run unopposed since taking the office in 2010 after Harold Denton retired. Vander Sanden was appointed to finish out the last few months of Denton's term and then was elected that same year. In recent years, the 38-year veteran of the office has faced some challenges over decisions made during his tenure involving shootings by police officers. One such case was Jereme Mitchell, who was shot and paralyzed by former Cedar Rapids police officer Lucas Jones, November 1, 2016. Vander Sanden was criticized by Mitchell's family and other community members for not having Mitchell testify before the grand jury that cleared Jones of wrongdoing. Mitchell sued the city of Cedar Rapids, its police department, and Officer Jones. The day before the case was to go to trial, the city's insurance carrier offered a settlement, and the Mitchell family received $8 million without the city acknowledging liability or fault. Vander Sanden on Tuesday didn't mention the Mitchell case or others, but said he has no regrets for the decisions he's made and stands by them. Vander Sanden said he never had his eye on being the county attorney. He said he's grateful for the opportunity to serve as the people's lawyer and always had wanted to work in the county prosecutor's office because he saw it as the most honorable thing one can do with a law license. He said he accomplished many things in the office and tried some tough cases, especially in the old days when prosecutors didn't have an assistant working with them on a big murder case. Vander Sanden said he thinks they have a better system now of having second or third chair on a case. Vander Sanden couldn't talk about two of the county's big recent murder cases, including Drew Blanick, convicted of killing Chris Bagley in 2018, because Blanick hasn't been sentenced yet, and the upcoming trial of Greg Davis, convicted in 2018 of killing his former girlfriend in 2017, but then overturned on appeal and set to be retried sometime next year. Vander Sanden will still be working on those cases through December. Moving now to the Iowa Today page, Iowa City finalizes the Ped Mall playground design. This story by Isabella Zaluska. The design for Iowa City's playground in the downtown pedestrian mall has been finalized and equipment has been ordered. The project steering committee and Parks and Recreation Commission agreed on a design after reviewing public input submitted by more than 550 respondents. The city shared a proposed concept for the playground in April and showed a redesigned version a month later after feedback from residents. The playground was last renovated 20 years ago. Parks and Rec Director Julie Seidel Johnson said the revised concept was then taken to playground manufacturers. I really think this will be a very fun place for the entire family to hang out downtown, Seidel Johnson said. She also said there have been some tweaks to the design due to what can be purchased. The tower with the slides will be accessible to the top level by stairs to make it easier for people to access, which wasn't shown before, she said. The appearance of the tower also changed, she added. Before, it looked more like a rocket ship, and now it looks more like an architectural feature that the committee on this felt like actually fit better with the downtown architecture, she said. Toddler swings and City of Literature elements also were added to the design. Seidel Johnson said it will take longer than normal to receive the equipment, which is why installation has been pushed to next year. Usually, playground equipment takes 8 to 10 weeks between the time you order it and the time you receive it, Seidel Johnson said. We've built in extra time because manufacturing plants are running so far behind right now. The city should receive the equipment by February, she added. Construction and installation of the playground are scheduled for spring of 2022. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest column today is by Tim Diebel, Masking in Love. In the early days of the pandemic, when protective measures were first being advised, my daughter lamented, "I wish the CDC hadn't said that masks primarily protected other people rather than the wearer. I wish they had lied and told us that masks were the simplest way to protect ourselves. We don't seem to care about protecting others, only ourselves." I've thought of that unflattering characterization afresh in recent weeks as the nation returns to classrooms and offices amid escalating COVID variant concerns. Personal freedom is once again facing off against collective well-being. I don't minimize the questions or the consternations. Whatever else COVID has accomplished, it has ignited a global exercise of values clarification. To mask, then, or not? To vaccinate, or not? To require them, or not? It isn't an easy time to be a leader in public life. Opposition to mandates has been loud. One dissent, however, perplexes me, the religious one. There are a few Christian traditions that avoid medical interventions, but very few. Most of us routinely welcome the ministrations of doctors and their antibiotic, surgical, and chemotherapeutic tools. More sharply to the moment, however, is the Judeo-Christian faith's persistent disinterest in personal privilege, reliably favoring mutual concern. Object to COVID precautions if you must, but don't ask religion to be complicit in that decision. One will search in vain for scriptural support of looking out for one's own well-being at another's expense. It's simply not there. Instead, the Hebrew and Christian scriptures are awash in admonitions to care for others, especially the most vulnerable. Us, more so than me. We are enjoined to love our neighbor as ourselves. For his part, Jesus went so far as to note that his followers would be known for their loving, and that there is no greater love than laying down one's life for another. Repeatedly, we are commanded to love, even when it is expensive, inconvenient, and uncomfortable, even when the recipient of that love is a stranger. I'm not surprised that people of religious fervor question or resist mandates, believing that we owe our allegiance to a higher authority. I am only surprised that we weren't among the first to mask up, that when mandates were issued, we didn't collectively respond. Quote, "You don't need to tell us, we are already wearing them, loving our neighbors as ourselves," end quote. And that was submitted by the Reverend Tim Diebel, who is a retired pastor living in northern Warren County. The guest column today by Nicholas Johnson is titled, "School Board Members Must Speak Out." Returning to my Iowa City home from Washington, D.C., confronting appeals of friends who were teachers, I agreed to run for school board, one, but promised only one term. Later, I tried to recruit new school board members. It wasn't easy. Perhaps it was my candid sales pitch. "Well, you may not get any pay, but at least you'll get a lot of grief." We spend less on K-12 than other countries, and our economy grows faster than education spending. But our federal, state, and local governments budget $734 billion for it annually, roughly the size of the defense budget. Given the responsibilities of school board members, it's remarkable they have neither entrance requirements nor training. But then neither do presidential appointees. As the U.S. Maritime Administrator at 29 and lacking administrative experience, I asked Commerce Secretary Luther Hodges about training. There was none. I pleaded for at least some advice. He said all I needed to remember was to pee every chance I got. Iowa City's much-beloved librarian Lolly Eggers served as my school board campaign treasurer and provided, as befits a librarian, a book. John Carver, Boards That Make a Difference. She had found it useful with her board. So did we. As Carver puts it, most advice for boards just teaches how to do the wrong things better. Our superintendent was preparing the board's agenda, complete with that what motions should be made and when. As I said at the time, we don't have board meetings. We have superintendent meetings to which the board members are invited and have the best seats. We changed that, redefining the roles of board members and superintendents. The Cedar Rapids School Board's board governance policies bear some similarity to what we did 23 years ago. Where they differ in practice involves the role of elected officials and group decision making. We made clear individual board members did not speak for the board, but they did speak and listen. As FCC commissioner, I wrote some 400 dissenting opinions. As a school board member, I wrote a newspaper column every 2 weeks about K-12 education. Sometimes painful for my colleagues, my writing was nonetheless tolerated as part of the group decision-making process. One reason democracies have multi-person legislative bodies, appellate courts, commissions, and school boards is the assumptions groups produce better decisions than authoritarian dictators. When group members are elected officials, they have an added obligation to express their views, communicate with and represent constituents, to be a voice for the voiceless, an ear for the unheard. There is not a single challenge confronting Iowa school boards that has not been discovered, diagnosed, treated, and resolved by one of America's 16,800 school boards, or the 19 countries that outscore the U.S. for quality of K-12 education. School board members need to spend hours regularly studying the literature, reporting, speaking out, and stimulating discussion. That and many other tasks are things that cannot properly be delegated to a superintendent and board chair. And that is submitted today by Nicholas Johnson, who is a former Iowa City School Board member. One letter to the editor today, Melissa Walker for Lynn Marr School Board. I am writing to express my support for Melissa Walker, candidate for Lynn Marr School Board. Her no-nonsense, pragmatic approach to problem-solving and her commitment to collaboration will be a welcome voice in our district. Having worked with Melissa early in my career, I found her to be caring, fair, and invested in the health and well-being of our community, specifically children in our community. For 20 years, Melissa has advocated for populations that are often overlooked. She makes data-informed decisions and considers facts, not just feelings, when making recommendations. As a graduate of Lynn Marr High School, with a student in the district myself now, I value Melissa's experience with fiscal management and her commitment to safe schools. With her experience in mental health and substance abuse prevention, I am confident she will advocate for evidence-based programs and the best chance of success for our students. I look forward to supporting Melissa on November 2, and I'm confident she is the right candidate to move our district forward in these challenging times. All community members in our district should have a vested interest in safe and healthy students, both mentally and physically. Melissa is the right woman to help make that happen in the Lynn Marr District. And that letter to today is signed by Jennifer Draper of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Wednesday, October 6, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituary page. First, in the other notices, Wilma Albang, age 92, died Sunday, October 3. Wilma lives in Anamosa. The Getch Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Blairstown, John Niebuhr, 75, died Monday, October 4. Phillips Funeral Home, Blairstown. In Decorah, Robert Dotseth, age 91, died Saturday, October 2. Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. Fort Atkinson, Linus Tupi, age 93, died Sunday, October 3. Schluter Ballack Funeral Home, Decorah. In Guttenberg, Ronald Laverne Schroeder, 79, died Monday, October 4. Took Allen Funeral Home, Guttenberg. In Marion, Alice L. Michael, age 69, died Friday, September 24, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service. In Marion, Eleanor Kennedy Walters, 93, died Tuesday, October 5, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. In Shelsburg, Roger W. Beck, 61, died Tuesday, October 5, Van Steenhuis Tien Funeral Home, Vinton. And in Vinton, Jerry L. Hanna, 87, died Tuesday, October 5, Phillips Funeral Home, Vinton. Moving now to the regular notices from Cedar Rapids, David Wayne Ackerley, 59, passed away at Mercy Medical Center Monday, October 4. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home Friday, October 8, from 2 to 6 p.m. From Cedar Rapids, Elaine Dice, 93, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, October 4, at her home. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, October 8, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will take place at 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, October 9, at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Jean Ann Barger, 86, died Saturday, October 2, at her home, surrounded by family. A prayer service will take place at 4 p.m. on Thursday, October 7, with a visitation to follow until 7 p.m. at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral mass will take place at 10 a.m. on Friday, October 8, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, with visitation 1 hour prior. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. In Cedar Rapids, Blaine, known as Pappy Phillips Sr., passed away October 3. Visitation is 9 to 11 a.m. Thursday, October 7 at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, with the funeral service to follow at 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will be held at the Linwood Cemetery, Cedar Rapids, with military honors. In Iowa City, Catherine M. Buck, 86, longtime resident of Iowa City, died at her home Tuesday, October 5. There will be a time of visitation on Friday, October 8, noon to 2 p.m. at Gay and Chia Funeral Home and Cremation Service, followed by burial at Memory Gardens Cemetery. For a complete obituary or to share a thought, memory, or condolence, visit the funeral home website, www.gayandchia.com. In Marengo, Jonathan Michael McElroy, 37, passed away October 2 from a motor vehicle accident. Service is at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 9 at Grace Lutheran Church, Blairstown, with Pastor Jeff Schanbacher officiating. Service will also be live streamed through the funeral service Facebook page. Burial will be at Kosta Cemetery, Kosta, Iowa. Condolences can be sent to the family at the newhousefuneralservice.com website. From Palo, Thomas Wayne Clymer, 61, of Palo, a celebration of life will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. on Saturday, October 9, at his sister Tamara's house, 505 Main Street, Palo. Tien Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting the family. In Cedar Rapids, Theodore, known as Ted Kosner Blehus, 78, died October 3 at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital. A celebration of life gathering will be from 3 to 6 p.m. Saturday, October 9 at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street Southwest, where there will be a time of reflection beginning at 6 p.m. Graveside services with military rites will be at noon Sunday, October 10 at Oakland Cemetery in Centerville. In Iowa City, Mary Ann Hotka, born May 30, 1929. She grew up in farms near Solon and attended Solon schools. A funeral mass will be held at St. Wenceslaus Church in Iowa City, 10 a.m. on Friday, October 8, with a visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. the evening prior at Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. A private burial will follow the mass. The family respectfully requests that masks be worn. In Lincoln, Nebraska, H. Paul Robinson. There will be no formal services. Memorials may be made to the family or for City of Waverly Parks and Recreation, Lawson Park updates and improvements. Paul watched the park being built and enjoyed many baseball games there. From Iowa City, Shirley Marie O'Brien, 68, died Monday, October 4, following a brief illness. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 1 p.m. Sunday, October 10, at St. Peter's Catholic Church, Cosgrove, with Father Robert Close officiating. Visitation will be from noon to 1 p.m. prior to the service. Burial will follow at St. Peter's Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to St. Peter's Catholic Church or to the Iowa City Eagles Lodge 695. Also in Iowa City, Daniel Dean Whalew, 62, died Sunday, October 3, surrounded with love by family following a courageous battle with pancreatic cancer. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 2 p.m. Friday, October 8, at St. Mary's Catholic Church with Father Stephen Witt officiating. Visitation will be Thursday from 5 to 7 at Lensing Oak Hill Funeral Service, 210 Holiday Road, Coralville. From Webster, Iva Irene Glandon, born January 14, 1930, passed away Tuesday, October 5, at the English Valley Care Center in North English at the age of 91. Celebration of Life service will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, October 8, at the Webster United Methodist Church in Webster. Burial will be in the Sordon Cemetery. Visitation will be on Thursday from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in North English. The family would like to request that attendees wear masks to both the visitation and the funeral service. Memorials are for the Webster United Methodist Church. From Central City, Gerald Arthur Kubik, 85, passed away Wednesday, September 29, at his home. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, October 8, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Center Point, with visitation to begin 1 hour prior. Burial will be in the Walker Cemetery, Walker, Iowa. In Marengo, Erna H. Mance, 92, died Monday, October 4, at Rose Haven Nursing Home, Marengo, after a 5-year battle with Lewy body dementia. Funeral services at 11 a.m. Friday, October 8, at the Amana Church, Main Amana, with Elder Emily Hoppe officiating. Burial will be in the Marengo Cemetery, Marengo. Visitation is 10 a.m. until the service at 11 a.m. Friday, October 8. A memorial fund has been established. Kloster Funeral Home, Marengo, is assisting the family with arrangements. Masks are required at all services. From Vinton, Wanda Loreen Thordson Nielsen McNitt passed away peacefully, age 90, Saturday, September 25, at Virginia Gay Nursing and Rehab following a lengthy battle with Parkinson's disease. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, October 8, at the First Christian Church in Vinton, with Pastor Richard Jumper officiating. Visitation will be 10 a.m. until the time of service at the church on Friday. Wanda's wishes were to have her body cremated and her ashes buried next to her parents at Woodbridge Cemetery near Buchanan, Iowa, at a later date. And the final obituary today, from Demen, Arizona, James, known as Jim Luders, 72, of Deming, Arizona, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died September 2 in Phoenix, Arizona. Services will be in the spring of 2022. Burial at Oakland Cemetery in Solon. The Tien Funeral Home is serving the family, and a full obituary may be found at the tienfuneralhome.com. Moving now to the sports page, the Gazette's Jeff Linder, Jeff Johnson, K.J. Pilcher, and Nathan Ford again answer questions about the Iowa high school football season. This time we have another Facebook submission, and the article is titled, Kudos to City High's Moore. Now, first question, who is your Coach of the Year front runner? Linder says, Mitch Moore of Iowa City High. Mojo, juice, whatever you want to call it, the Little Hawks have it again. Honorable mention nods to Jim Lovell of Linmar and Jared Cullum of North Lynn. Johnson says, it's got to be Mitchell Moore at City High, right? The Little Hawks are 6-0 and one of the top teams in the Class 5A. Not sure anyone saw that coming. Tim Lovell at Linmar also gets strong consideration. I'll throw Jared Cullum at North Lynn in there, too. Even if he gives me guff about my dislike of going out of the shotgun from the opponent's one-yard line, LOL. Pilcher says, this might be the deepest category of candidates. You have coaches in their first year as head coach or first year with a new program. Iowa City High's Mitch Moore, Linmar's Tim Lovell, Iowa City Regina's Jason Dumont, and Matt Hattie at Clear Creek Amana. Cedar Rapids Prairie's Mark Bliss has the Hawks in the rankings, despite missing a couple of starters. Right now, I'm going with Dyersville Beckman's Mark Atwater. The Blazers are 6-0 and ranked 6th in a competitive Class 1A. They have 4 wins over teams 500 or better, including Waterloo Columbus. Beckman averages 42 points per game with an average winning margin of 30 points a contest. And Ford chimes in, Mitch Moore of Iowa City High, a proud program, is back among the high school elites in his first year of charge. You can sense the excitement around the program, from pregame hype videos to a robust social media presence to a banner in the cheerleaders displayed before a recent game that read in part, In Moore We Trust. That's all been backed up on the field during a 6-0 start. Article continues with other back and forth questions for the four contributors. And I'll move on to events of area interest in sports today. In men's soccer, Luther is at Coe at 7:30. In women's volleyball, Iowa is at Wisconsin at 6 p.m., Kirkwood at Iowa Central at 7. And women's soccer finds Luther at Coe, UNI at Missouri State. On TV today, the Cardinals are at the Dodgers at 7 p.m. The WNBA playoffs, Sun at Sky, 7 p.m. on ESPN. The Aces are at Mercury, 9 o'clock p.m. And in college golf, Blessings Collegiate Invitational takes place today at 3 p.m. on the Golf Channel. If you're listening on the radio, the Cardinals are at the Dodgers at 7 p.m. KGYM will call the game. And in local talk shows, Gym Class at 3 p.m., Todd Bromelkamp Show with Alex Kuhn at 4 p.m., Home Plate at 6:10. Turning to the community page, here are some things to do today. Family and online Mother Goose on the Loose, a virtual nursery rhyme program for newborns to three-year-olds, comes from the Cedar Rapids Public Library, 9:30 a.m., online at www.crlibrary.org. The cost is free and it's open to all ages. In the community and museum category, Cedar Rapids Area Genealogy Library. Research your family tree with the help of library volunteers. Park in the rear, enter through the back door. It's open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Masonic Building, 813 First Avenue Southeast, lower level, Cedar Rapids. Again, free and open to all ages. In the education category, the two decades after 9/11 have given rise to a host of conspiracy theories myths and alternative facts in both mass media and niche online communities. With wilder theories created constantly, how do we sift through the infinite information at our fingertips? That program will be presented at 6 o'clock, runs from 6 to 7 p.m. at Mount Mercy University, Flaherty Community Room, which is 204 Basil Hall, 1330 Elmhurst Drive Northeast in Cedar Rapids, free and open to all ages. And lastly, in the music category, Eddie Picard Trio. Jazz music from Eddie Picard piano, vocals, Craig Dove bass, and Rich Martin vibraphone. 7 to 9 p.m. at the Bohemian, 1029 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids, free and open to all ages. An acclaimed historian will headline events for the Hoover Library. Nationally acclaimed presidential historian and biographer Richard Norton Smith will provide the keynote address following a reception and dinner October 23 at the Brown Deer Golf Club in Coralville. Smith currently is working on a biography about President Gerald R. Ford and will discuss a segment from the book detailing the final 2 days of Saigon's collapse, told with an intimacy that focuses on Ford during what he said was the low point of his presidency. Smith served as director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum from 1988 to 1993, and then as director for the Eisenhower, Reagan, and Ford Libraries until 2001. An author of 6 books, he was also the founding director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. An evening with Richard Norton Smith begins at 6 p.m. with a cash bar reception, followed by dinner and a presentation at 6:30. Registration for the dinner is required as seats are limited, and registration closes October 19. Tickets are $50 for Hoover Presidential Foundation members and their guests, $65 for the public. On October 24 at 1 p.m., Smith will join Tim Walsh, Dwight Miller, and moderator Dr. Thomas Schwartz in, quote, a Hoover Forum, Presidents Learning About Presidents, end quote. The speakers will examine and share stories of presidents and first ladies who visited the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum over the years. 6 former U.S. presidents have visited the West Branch Library, along with many other political and historical dignitaries. This event is free with advance registration. It will be held at the Hyatt Regency Ballroom in Coralville and is expected to last 2 hours. Also on the community page, Room to Breathe, this story by Kat Russell. Hiawatha Library expansion offers space for more programs. After years of operating in a space that was too small, the Hiawatha Public Library has completed a $4.2 million expansion and renovation that nearly tripled the library's space. This project started years ago, Director Jeanneel Weeks said. We have had long outgrown the old space, and the facility that we were working in was just too small for the business that we were doing. The original single-story library at 150 West William Street, which was remodeled during the expansion project, was 8,543 square feet. The library is now on 2 levels with 22,000 square feet. Quote, what we did was build an addition to the existing library by adding a lower level to the west side of the original building, end quote, Weeks said. In addition to adding the lower level, we remodeled the old part of the library so the whole thing matches. And if you had never been here before, you wouldn't necessarily know that had been an addition. Weeks said the library's capital campaign raised $2 million for the work. Another $1 million came from local option sales tax, and the city bonded the final $1.2 million. The original library, Weeks said, was cramped and lacked enough room for adults, teens, and children to have their own spaces. We have always been very, very busy, and the old space was crowded and not very comfortable, she said. Now the library feels open and welcoming. It's like we have room to breathe. We just have so much more space to work with now. Among the changes is a larger young adult section, and an improved children's section with separate computer areas for both. Also added, meeting and study rooms, workspaces, office storage, and larger circulation desks. The community room, which can be used for events, classes, and group activities, also was expanded and designed so it can be divided into two rooms, Weeks said. We have programming for all ages, and we're hoping that this will really affect the amount of programming that we do and the types of programming that we do, Weeks said. Possibilities that have opened up for us now, and I think that will also result in a lot more benefits for the community, she added. Weeks noted the library, like many other libraries, offers services that go beyond book borrowing and computer use. We are a certain size library in a smaller community, but we're two blocks from Cedar Rapids, and so we serve a huge area of people, and 75% or so of our circulation is non-Hiawatha people, she said. So we're kind of like a suburban library, but we're serving a larger urban population, and we have all kinds of people using the library, and they all have different needs. Weeks said the library staff has all been trained in trauma-informed response and in aiding homeless patrons. The staff also refers people to social services and other local resources. We try with whatever we can, she said. We try to help with food insecurity in the neighborhood here, so we have a little free pantry where people can take food or leave food, she said. We also have HACAP Mobile Food Bank come here to the library. We do blood drives. We offer proctoring services. We have notaries of the public. Whatever the community needs, we will try to figure out a way to make it happen. We are that community hub that people know they can come to, and we don't really have another community hub in the city, Weeks said. So it's not just books. It's not just audiobooks or movies or any of the tangible things, she added. A lot of it is not tangible, and the expansion of the building is also an expansion of possibilities. I think it will make it so that we can do more. Closing out with some weather tidbits, normal high for today is 68. We're looking for a high of 77 and a low of 61. The record high of 92 degrees was set in 1963. The record low of 22 was set in 1935. Look for a chance of showers tomorrow, the high of 73. Getting warmer for the weekend, Friday 79, Saturday 84. We are in the new moon phase. Today's sunrise was at 6:40 p.m. Excuse me, daylight today. Sunset tonight, 6:40 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow, 7:10 a.m. That gives us 11 hours and 31 minutes of daylight. You have been listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Wednesday, October 6th. On Iris. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on the website iowaradioreading.org anytime. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. The Kingdom of Egypt prospered for 3,000 years in the desert. Its success depended on strong leadership, written language, mathematics and engineering, but most importantly, on the flooding of the Nile, which happened each June through September. Farmers developed an irrigation system that trapped floodwaters in their fields using dams. They let the water recharge the soil for a few months while the organics settled out, providing nutrients to the earth. They then released the water to the receding river and plant their crops. In this way, year after year, the fields could produce enough food to sustain a large population living in the desert. The floods were the direct result of African monsoons, which fell on the highlands of Ethiopia, the headwaters of the Nile. If the rain didn't fall, the Nile wouldn't flood. And there were some years that it didn't. Volcanic activity in the region filled the atmosphere with ash and gas, reflecting the sun's heat, producing evaporation, and therefore rainfall. Geologic and historical records now allow us to closely correlate volcanic eruptions with reduced Nile flooding, reduced crop production, reduced tax revenue for the state, and higher incidence of famine and revolt from the populace. Especially high volcanic activity in the last 300 years of the Egyptian kingdom contributed to its eventual fall to the Romans. Yet another example of how connected human civilization has been and continues to be to freshwater supply, weather patterns, and the geology of Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, keeping you connected on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.